Welcome to the Architectural History Podcast, a podcast dealing with histories of architecture in the built environment. In our first series, Architecture And, we speak to a number of academics, architects, writers and thinkers to discuss space, buildings and cities, and to think through contemporary debates and issues.
Hello, Jess.
Hi, Matt. How are you?
Yeah, I'm well. How are you?
I'm good, thank you.
Excellent. So we're back with the Architectural History Podcast, and this week we're talking about architecture and leisure, which was your idea, Jess. You got the guests for this one. So what's the concept and who are we talking to about it?
Yes, it was my idea. And I think you can tell that this episode was recorded during the lockdown earlier this year. And I think the sort of interest in leisure and socialising very much came out of that point in time when we'd experienced over a year of lockdowns and restrictions on where we could go and what we can do and who we could meet. And it really sort of put into perspective how we felt about public spaces and places of sociability. We'd spent most of our time in our homes or in our places of work, whether that was physical or online, and socializing had been limited to outdoor spaces like doorsteps and parks. So the pandemic also changed our perspective on experiences which had previously been normal, like being in a crowd, sitting next to a stranger in a theatre, dancing in a sweaty crowd of people in a nightclub. It seemed like something from the distant past.
And it's worth saying I've been in a theatre, a nightclub and at a music festival in the last month or so, which I really wouldn't have expected that I would have got to do if we'd been, when we first recorded these interviews with the guests.
Exactly. It's really put a different slant on it once again. And like you say, Matt, some of us have sort of dived into going back into these spaces. Some people are really jubilant about the opportunity, whereas others are maybe more anxious. But either way, I think our experience and understanding of spaces of leisure and sociability has really changed. That what it means to go to the theatre or go to a nightclub has a new and different meaning in the aftermath of the pandemic. So the thinking behind this episode was to look at how spaces for leisure and socialising have always been shaped by the time, by the cultural values, the social norms, the fashions of the time. So I invited three historians who researched dance halls, theatres and nightclubs. And we talked about them and how the buildings that are designed or used for leisure reveal changing ideas about, you know, what we should be doing in our leisure time, what sociability is, but also how they reveal much bigger stories about social and cultural change over the last kind of 100, 120 years. So the three historians that we're joined by are Dr. James Knott, who's lecturer in the social history at the University of St. Andrews. James is a social and cultural historian, and his book, Going to the Palais, A Social and Cultural History of Dancing and Dance Halls in Britain, was published in 2015. We're also joined by Dr. Catherine Rossi, who's Associate Professor in Design History at Kingston University. Kat's research interests range very broadly from craft to nightclubs. And in 2019, she co-curated an exhibition titled Night Fever, Designing Club Culture, 1960 to Today, which opened at the Vitre Design Museum and has toured various museums and most recently was in the V&A in Dundee in May 2021. And finally, we're joined by Dr. Alistair Fair, who's reader in architectural history at the University of Edinburgh. Alistair's interested in the relationship between architecture and wider social and political history, and his book, Modern Playhouses, An Architectural History of Britain's New Theatres, 1945 to 1985, was published in 2018. So I started by talking to James Knott about dance halls around the time at the end of the First World War. So James, we're going to talk about dance halls. Can you start by telling me what is a dance hall?
Well, it's a building that's really peculiar to the period just after the First World War up until the mid-1960s. As the name suggests, its purpose was for dancing, public dancing. And dance halls were permanent buildings open for dancing most days of the year. Now, obviously, people have been dancing before this, but these were a new development in the urban landscape of British towns and cities. They get their origins really drawing from the upper class ballrooms that you used to get in country houses, larger hotels and private clubs that the upper classes went to, but also from working class origins in the back rooms of pubs where people used to kind of get together for a song and dance. The growing number of public halls that were developed in the Victorian period with this new civic culture. And also, as Victorian seaside resorts opened, you get ballrooms there. So one of the most famous being the Tower Ballroom in Blackpool, which opens in 1894. So these things were the kind of pre-runners to the dance hall. But what was different about the dance hall was that it was a permanent feature that was aiming at the working and lower middle classes. So there was no need to hire a musician anymore. There was no need to rent a venue, which could be expensive, or organise refreshments. It was there. It was a ready-made form of entertainment. And in that respect, it's representing huge social and cultural changes. I mean, the dance hall basically is the product of a rising prosperity for the majority of the population, and a huge increase in dancing that takes place just after the First World War. There's this huge boom in dancing.
So this boom that happens just after the First World War, why was that? What was going on?
Well, there are a number of reasons for this huge explosion of interest in dancing. Perhaps most fundamental were social and economic changes. So the majority of the population, shorter working weeks, increased rate wages, the development of holidays with pay. It means there's more money and more time for leisure activities. We've also got changing social mores, particularly the position of women. You know, the role of women in public and interactions between men and women in public make public dancing more acceptable, although, as we'll see, it's not totally accepted by everybody. So you've got these big social and economic developments. You've also got new music, new dances. So first ragtime, then jazz, and these new couple dances that come with it. That's the real kind of big change. Prior to that, there'd been group dances. The waltz was a couple dance. That had been popular. But new music called for new dances, which were coordinating couples getting together. So it's really attractive for that kind of reason. And I guess another reason is that just after the First World War, there is a desire to enjoy for enjoyment from the population more generally. And this is something as well that I hadn't really considered until our own pandemic, is that, of course, following the First World War, we have the Spanish flu. And clearly, after the kind of restrictions that were put in place, similar to our own, there was a huge desire to get out there and party, basically. I mean, people wanted to be together and have a good time. So the dance hall offered an amazing venue for that to take place.
So dance halls are these unique spaces for sociability, and they served new fashions in music and dancing, but did they have other social functions alongside dancing?
Yeah, I mean, the dance hall is not just a building where people get together to have a dance. It really takes on a fundamental role in the social and cultural lives of working and lower middle class communities in Britain after the First World War and right up until the mid-60s. Perhaps its most important function was as a place for dating. You know, this is where everybody met their future partner. My own parents met in a dance hall. That's how I became interested in it. So they're major sites for courtship. And this is one of the factors that is soon recognised by the wider society. I think in 1950, the Daily Mirror estimated that 70% of people first met in a dance hall, which is probably accurate. the key thing about dancing in this era was that it was couple dancing. So heterosexual couple formation was the central function of the dance hall and the activity of dancing. And there was a kind of prescribed set of conventions for getting a partner. Forming a couple was absolutely normal and integral to the process. And so that made, dating much, much easier. Also much better than the cinema, because you can actually talk to one another in the dance floor and you're actually quite intimate and close. It's also particularly important for women and for female emancipation. The dance hall really is one of the key social public spaces where women enter not only on their own terms, but actually have a kind of head start over men in the period after the First World War. It's a female public space in the sense that dancing is much more popular with women. Sometimes there could be up to twice as many women as there were men in the dance hall. Depending on the time of the evening, women used to come in on their own and dance with each other for the first part of the evening. Men usually were in the pub at this time. And so that really helped develop a kind of gender identity, peer group identity for women. There are other social functions as well, and dance hall is key in the development of youth culture. I mean, a lot of the dances were very energetic, the Charleston, the jive, the jitterbug. So really only younger people could do them. It was part of the social equipment of youth growing up in the 20s, 30s, 40s and 50s that you learned how to dance. As one social observer put it in the 1930s, when you leave school, you learn to work, to smoke, and to dance. Basically, if you didn't dance, you were out, that you weren't going to meet anybody.
So what was the role of designers in determining the function and the use of dance halls? And did dances themselves impact on the spaces?
Well, the first design issue for the dance halls was, for the dance hall owners, was that these were luxurious palaces of glamour that appealed to this democratization of leisure. They were making levels of service and kind of atmospheres that previously been reserved for higher levels of society. So there was a lot of emphasis on luxury, glamour, escapism in the dance halls. I mean, just the very name that was adopted for dance halls, Palais de Danse, palaces of dance, kind of hints at that aim. So from the minute you walk through the doors, you're kind of entering a kind of dreamland. There's all uniformed attendants. You've got smart waiters and waitresses. Each palais tried to outdo its competitors with kind of lavishness. In Glasgow, for example, at the Plaza, which was opened in the 1920s, the dance floor was sunk below the level of the surrounding table space and illuminated with coloured footlights. And in the centre of the dance floor was a fountain, which was decorated with flowers and which had goldfish swimming inside. Similarly, at the Nottingham Palais de Danse, which opened in 1925, they went even further. Their fountain could rise to 20 feet and it was illuminated with a series of changing coloured lights. There were even themed dance halls. At Tony's Dance Hall in Birmingham in the mid-1930s, the whole interior was decorated in a Middle Eastern theme. It was made out like a mosque with prayer mats hanging from the walls and illuminated stars in the ceiling. So, that was one response to this desire for kind of affordable luxury. The other relates more clearly to this social function of romance and dating. And the dance halls themselves soon realized that they were a major center for meeting members of the opposite sex. So they tried to create romantic settings. This is a black box space. Most of the dance halls don't have windows. So lighting was really important. There were darkened spaces and the lights were lowered. Some Some dances would get a kind of light, a red light, and then they would change the filter. So the kind of ambience would change according to the type of dance. But you had darkened corners and so on, table spaces, places where you could sit out after you'd met on the dance floor and perhaps take the acquaintance further. As time progressed, they become more explicit. So in this function, the dance halls start to create things like Cupid's Bar. You know, in the Locarno, Glasgow in the 1950s, they have a bar that is called Cupid's Bar with love hearts everywhere and so on and so forth. So it becomes increasingly obvious what they're doing. The other way they kind of try and manipulate the space is providing facilities to adjust appearance. So obviously, all part and parcel of meeting somebody. These go from fairly basic in the 20s and 30s, dressing rooms with mirrors and so on, to by the end of the period, by the 50s and 60s, at the Mayfair Ballroom in Newcastle, for example, which had opened in 1961, there were the ladies' powder rooms, and they had freestanding makeup stations decorated with pink candy stripe wallpaper, bags for shoes and makeup. The Locarno Bradford in 1961, the men too were catered for. They had the stag room where they were provided with electric shavers, hair cream and shoe shine. So they're responding in this kind of way. In terms of how the dancers manipulate the space, well, you know, they take control of it, really. It becomes really ritualistic. So there was a common entrance for everybody, but the dancers themselves tended to separate themselves, men on one side, women on the other side of the hall. And the convention of the day was that men asked women to dance. There was some exception to that, but that was broadly the rule. And they would magically kind of come together as the music started. The men would approach the women, take them off and have their dance. But perhaps most obviously was in the development of youth culture, where the dancers shaped their own culture. This took the form of even separate dance halls that were associated with particular youth age groups. Even in the 1920s in Dundee, for example, there are about 30 different halls, and they all catered for, you know, specific age groups. But more common was that young people would kind of section off part of the dance hall for their own use. And this became increasingly the case when they started to adopt different dancing styles away from the kind of what we now know as ballroom dancing, foxtrot and so on, towards jiving, jitterbug, more freestyle. They would move over to a certain part of the hall. Sometimes they'd put chairs around so that they weren't kind of interacting with the other dancers. So, you know, this was one of the ways that dancers manipulated the space.
I was really struck listening to James speak there, not just the parallels between the 1920s and the 2020s in terms of the end of restrictions of Spanish influenza and COVID-19, but also just found it so vivid, his description of a social world with these sort of ritualized rules and these expectations about how you act in a place. I find it incredible to think of sort of like my grandparents or my great-grandparents experiencing that themselves and acting as one does in one's historical moment.
Absolutely. And I think as well, you can sort of turn that on today, can't you? And think the way that we take it for granted that you behave in particular spaces of leisure or sociability, in 50 or 100 years time, people will look back and be like, what was that kind of crazy yes. convention for behaving in that kind of way? It's really interesting.
So who are we speaking to next?
So then I spoke to Kat Rossi about her research into the design of nightclubs in Europe after the Second World War. So what types of spaces are nightclubs?
Well, in essence, a nightclub is a space where people come together to dance, but not only to dance, to kind of to socialise, to be together. And I think that collective idea of being together is a really important part of the nightclub. So immediately I'm talking about function, But of course, there's the kind of the architectural, the built nature of nightclubs. And while they have their origins in dance halls, in jazz clubs of the early 20th century, nightclubs, as I really focus on them, are spaces that emerged in the post-Second World War period and are spaces that are about that use of new technology, in particular lighting and sound, to create artificial environments where people can come together for kind of freedom and self-expression in the wee hours. And that could happen in a kind of highly conceived space, a highly elaborate, highly designed space, but it could also happen in a field or in a warehouse or on a beach or in these other kind of looser, even outdoor kinds of spaces.
So your research focuses on these radical discos, which were avant-garde spaces in the 1960s, 70s and later. How did these clubs relate to the society and politics and culture at the time?
So radical disco is really just a term that we came up with for an exhibition that I was working on. But it's a term that describes a series of nightclubs that were designed by architects associated with radical architecture in 1960s and 1970s Italy. And I first came to this research a few years ago looking at a nightclub called Space Electronic, which was designed by a group of architects called Gruppo 9999 and which opened in Florence in 1969. And this club was fascinating in all sorts of ways. But I think one of the primary ways it was interesting was that my understanding up to that point, and I think many people's understanding, was that architects associated with radical design actually didn't build anything. They rejected the conventions of architecture as part of their rebellion against kind of modernist architecture at that time, and also the commercial associations of architecture. But actually what emerged through the more reading I was doing and a few other researchers was understanding that actually there was one type of place that architects like Gruppo 9999, also Gruppo Strum, Gruppo UFO and Superstudio, there was one kind of space that they actually were designing for real, and that was the nightclub, which were called variously pipers. That was the kind of term used in Italy at the time, or we might call them discos or different kinds of spaces. And these architects saw in these spaces a kind of freedom that wasn't afforded to them elsewhere. There weren't many building opportunities, it's worth saying, for architects in 60s, 70s Italy, certainly not these young kind of architects. But also the nightclub, as a fairly new type of space, a kind of post-World War II type of space, was kind of untethered or not weighted down by any of the conventions of an existing architectural typology. It didn't have the weight of something that, you know, kind of older generations had used, like the dance hall, for example. But it was also not, so it wasn't codified and it wasn't commercialized as a type of space. So that was, I think, alluring, the freedom it offered. But also they conceived the nightclub as a space that could allow a greater connection between the user and the architecture. So less of a top-down kind of architecture and more the idea of a space that was highly participatory, highly flexible, in which the user could act on and modify the space.
So the architects that you're talking about were clearly experimenting with what design could do in these spaces. But nightclubs were also interpreted during this period by cultural theorists such as Roland Barthes. Can you tell us a bit more about that?
Yes. Yeah, so in 1978, a nightclub called Le Palace opened in Paris, and it was in an old 1920s theatre that had been transformed into a nightclub by two architects, Patrick Berger and Vincent Barré. And I should also add the side note that the costumes of people who worked there were designed by Thierry Mugler. So it was a very interesting kind of space. And Roland Barthes was invited by Vogue Homme to review the space, which was, you know, interesting in itself. And he really admired how the interior had been transformed. You know, the whole space had been used, from the stage to the curtains to the balconies to the orchestra pit, which in fact had been turned into a dance floor. And he was really struck by one design feature in particular. And that was this massive sphere-like installation of coloured neon tubes, which was in essence a lighting installation, that hung from the ceiling and which would apparently rise and fall over the dancers in the course of the evening. And seeing this and this huge light installation, it prompted Barthes to ask, and I'll kind of paraphrase him here, that actually whether one of the key technologies or materials of the kind of modern age is actually light. And he talked about how in a theatre, or an ordinary theatre, let's say perhaps not some of the spaces that Alistair talks about, In theatres, light is normally fixed and it's kind of remote and we don't necessarily see its workings. While in the palace, light is part of the attraction. The technology is part of the attraction. But also the use of light means that everybody in this nightclub is an actor. The whole place is still a theatre, but rather than there's an audience and a cast, in fact, that distinction that between who is watching and who is being watched changes throughout the evening.
So in that sense, how important is experience and atmosphere to nightclubs?
Experience and atmosphere are hugely important to the design of nightclubs. There hasn't been a lot written about the kind of theory of nightclubs, and maybe that's a good thing. You don't want too much theorising of these kinds of spaces in a way. But one of the ways that I find really useful for thinking about nightclubs comes from Carlo Caldini, who was one of the architects of Gruppo 9999. And he talked about how the architecture of space electronic was non-existent, was inexistent. And that isn't to say that it wasn't a space made of bricks and mortar, it very much was. But really, that wasn't the defining architecture of space electronic or other nightclubs. Really, it's about light, it's about sound, and it's about what people do in there. So from the kind of beginning of the experimentation in these spaces, we have this understanding that it's the things that happen in there rather than the physical nature of clubs that that is a defining feature of these spaces. But we also see that understanding of the importance of experience and atmosphere in, for example, the work of Ian Schrager. So Ian Schrager and Steve Rubell were the two owners, of course, Studio 54, which opens in New York in the late 1970s. And while they didn't design those spaces, they employed architects, Scott Bromley and Ron Dowd. And interestingly, they also employed lighting designers from Broadway to create, to transform what had been a TV studio into, this kind of hugely significant nightclub, perhaps not in music terms, but in kind of social and cultural terms, hugely important. And Schrager talks about how he took real design lessons from that experience of designing Studio 54, but also Palladium, which was designed by Arata Isozaki. And he talks about, and I kind of quote here, the idea of magic ambience and elevated experience, but also we could say sensorial stimulation. And he took those ingredients, he talks about this, that he took those ingredients into his hugely successful hotel brands, spaces like Morgan's, Paramount, Gramercy Park Hotel, which if you think about the lobbies, those the kind of the bars as you enter, the foyers, They're all about atmosphere, about creating a kind of atmosphere. So he's understood that, and that's one of the many, many design legacies from club culture that I think isn't really been recognised enough, that actually a lot of the innovation that happens in clubs then feeds into our everyday. But also I'd add a voice here from, not from architecture, but from music, Simon Reynolds, who's talked about rave culture in Britain. And he talks about this particular quality of rave music, and he's talking about rave music as different from other music genres. And he says that rave music has this effective charge, that it really gets into you, it makes you want to move in this particular collective way. And obviously people might have different views on what they think about rave music, whether it makes them want to sit up or sit down and ignore the music or get up and dance. But I think this idea of the effective charge, this importance of feeling, of atmosphere, of effect and agency are all key qualities that are particularly heightened in nightclub architecture.
So nightclubs can be spaces for hedonism and even for illicit or illegal activity. How have architects thought about that or dealt with it in their design?
I think the different attitude towards what clubs are for and the kind of social interactions in them is one of the distinctions between dance halls, which arguably belong to an earlier generation, and nightclubs, which you could say kind of embrace that kind of more deviant, in a way, aspects of human nature. Deviant, but kind of important valves that they for all these different kinds of ways that we find ourselves, experiment with ourselves, experiment with others. And I think that the key voice for that is really Nigel Coates. So Nigel Coates has designed a number of bars and restaurants, but also he's designed nightclubs. So he designed Taksim Park, which was a nightclub that opened in Istanbul in 1990 in an old textiles factory. And he turned this huge kind of industrial space into a kind of fantasy airport that even had kind of plane wings like suspended from the ceiling, but also it used luggage carriers as little pods where you could sit in and kind of canoodle with others. And he talked a lot about how nightclubs are not so visible as a form of architecture. They're not like that very conspicuous public realm space like some of the theatres that Alistair talked about. Instead, they're deliberately hidden. They're often deliberately inconspicuous. You know, they're underground, they're upstairs, they're around the corner. They're not always these kind of very grand, open kind of spaces. But the point with them being often literally underground, but at least hidden and sealed off from the world, is that they allow what he calls unlikely, taboo, or at best occasional behaviours. So they have this kind of heterotopian quality to them that's actually really important. That, you know, there's a site for experimentation, for doing things that, yes, are classified as deviant or might even be kind of deemed kind of illegal activity, certainly if we think about different kind of homosexual kind of cultures, the kind of the importance of these spaces, of safe spaces for LGBTQ communities. That freedom they offer is important in all sorts of ways.
Absolutely. And all I can think throughout your talk is how much these are the spaces that we're missing, that we've missed during the pandemic.
Absolutely. And I think that's the story of nightclubs in the 21st century has been one of huge transformation and in some ways decline. And that was true even before the pandemic, you know, huge numbers of clubs closing in the UK and internationally, partly in it, due to, we could say, gentrification is seen as one cause, also changing kind of lifestyle behaviours, you know, and the different things that different generations want to do. But the pandemic, you know, nightclubs have been closed for over a year now, and let alone the economic ramifications of that, many of them are already not going to be opening again, is the importance of those as spaces for, as safe spaces, as spaces for people to be who they can't be in their everyday lives.
Yeah, I thought that was really interesting what Kat was saying about these very radical Italian architectural practices in the context of radical politics in the 1970s, not really willing to be involved in the conventional architectural industry, not really wanting to build buildings because of certain like socioeconomic and political positions that they held, but instead finding nightclubs as these transient, semi-permanent or sort of these like interventions into the social life of the city that served the interests of their practice. And that connection with radical theory through Roland Barthes as well, I thought that's an astonishing thing. Can you imagine sort of being in the nightclub one night and then Roland Barthes is standing in the corner with a pipe, like taking notes?
Oh, I hope that's how it happened.
Yeah.
No, absolutely. Kat described them as spaces of freedom, didn't she? Not only for the architects designing them, but for the people within them, which I think was a great idea.
Brill. So who are we talking to last today?
So we finished by talking to Alistair Fair, who looks at post-Second World War theatre design in the UK. So what do theatres tell us about how leisure was understood in post-war Britain?
I think theatres are a really interesting way of thinking through post-war British society and politics, because leisure generally was a subject of real interest to policymakers and to reformers after the Second World War. It was a subject that was of interest across the political spectrum, but particularly so in the Labour Party. The reasons for this were several-fold, but particularly the fact that people had increasing amounts of leisure time as the working week reduced. And there were really optimistic predictions that by the end of the 20th century, people would only be working for a few hours a day. So the question was, what were people going to do with these vast amounts of leisure time that were thought to be opening up in front of them? Particularly in the Labour Party, there was a worry that people would stay at home, that they would become individualists who would be tempted by material things. So encouraging communal forms of activity, forms of leisure that might be understood to be educational, these became priorities for some. And as far as theatre was concerned, the key thing was the introduction of routine public subsidies for the arts in the middle of the 1940s. We get the Arts Council of Great Britain, founded in 1945. That's followed in 1948 by the Local Government Act, which allowed local authorities to subsidise the arts from the rates. Now, certain judgments underlay all of this, not least a sense that some forms of leisure activity were productive, and particularly within theatre, that the mixed programmes of repertory theatres with classic works, Shakespeare, new plays, these things were thought to be more valuable than variety and thus more worthy of public investment. So there's a sort of cultural paternalism at work here to some extent, but also an egalitarianism, the idea that giving people access to the arts was a good thing. Jenny Lee was Britain's first Minister for the Arts. She was appointed after the election of the Labour government in 1964. And she argued that this really was one of the duties of the state, to give people access to the bastions of high culture, that no one should feel excluded from the arts. And of course, we can see broader parallels there with the way in which higher education was being opened up in the same period.
So how does theatre architecture change in the second half of the 20th century? And what particular buildings show those changes?
For me, I think the key point in post-war theatre architecture is that this is not necessarily a radical form of modern architecture. And the new theatres really balanced continuity and change. So if we look, for example, at a building like the Belgrade Theatre in Coventry, the Belgrade was the first major new theatre to be built in Britain since the Second World War. It opened in March 1958. And this was a building which looked completely unlike pre-war theatres and certainly very different from the kind of classic Victorian or Edwardian theatre with all of its ornament and its gold cherubs and so on. The Belgrade was inspired by the style of the Festival Hall in London and by Scandinavian modern architecture. It's got big windows, it's got modern forms of chandeliers, it's got Scandinavian-inspired detailing. And it aroused a lot of comment at the time. Critics pointed out that this building did not look like a theatre because it was so different from the kind of theatre architecture that they were used to. But this was actually understood as a very positive thing, as a way almost of symbolising the new context of subsidised post-war theatre. And this sense of theatres looking different continues into the 1960s. We increasingly see buildings that you might describe as brutalist on account of their exposed concrete, buildings like the Nottingham Playhouse or the National Theatre. But it's not just that they looked different. There are different sorts of spaces within them. Extensive foyers which were shared by everybody. So if you've bought a seat in a cheap part of the auditorium, you'd no longer be sent around the back of the building. Everybody uses the main entrance. Everybody shares the same foyer spaces. And these foyers were much bigger than they'd been in pre-war theatres, and certainly much bigger than the kind of cramped foyers that you might be familiar with if you go to the theatre in the West End of London. And these spaces were often open all day. They'd contain a cafe, perhaps a bar. There'd be space for exhibitions. This is the idea of the theatre as a social centre. And again, that's an important change in the post-war period, which again relates to the fact that increasing amounts of public subsidy is being spent on these buildings and on running them. Something like the National Theatre in London, which finally opens in 1976, is a veritable sort of palace of culture, a magnificent and monumental building made out of board-marked concrete. So these are very solid, very fixed.
So in that sense, how do theatres relate to public spaces in cities?
Theatres have a really interesting relationship with the city in this period. If we go back to the Victorian Edwardian period, because theatres then were largely run commercially, they often are tucked slightly out of sight. They perhaps have one major facade, but otherwise are perhaps on more marginal sites within the cityscape. Now, with the advent of public subsidy after the Second World War, there's an opportunity to change that, to realise theatres on much more prominent sites. And some theatres certainly were conceived as major public buildings, like the National in London on its prominent site on the south bank of the River Thames. Sometimes they form part of a civic complex alongside other local government buildings. I mean, you might think of examples like the Birmingham Repertory Theatre of 1971 as an example of that. It's situated amongst other Birmingham City Council buildings. It wears its civic subsidy rather proudly. But others were brought rather closer to everyday life. In Leicester, for example, there was great debate about whether the new theatre there should be built within the civic complex or whether it should be built in the shopping centre, in the shopping area. And the Leicester Haymarket eventually opens within the Haymarket shopping centre, not alongside the local government buildings. Similarly, Derby Playhouse in the middle of the 1970s, it's in a shopping centre. It is part of everyday life. So we've got sort of two trends, the idea of the kind of monumental civic building on the one hand, and that is something new, but alternatively, the idea that you embed the theatre within the life of the city. In Sheffield, the Crucible Theatre's foyers were described at least by the architects as part of a route through the city centre, up the hill from the railway station. And they had the idea that people would be walking through the theatre on their journey through the city centre, that they might stop and buy a cup of coffee. They might perhaps even buy a theatre ticket. So these buildings start to break down the boundaries between themselves and the surrounding cityscape. And in a way, perhaps suggesting the idea of theatre, the arts, of leisure embedded in a kind of wider pattern of modern life.
So theatre buildings then are adaptable spaces used differently through different times of the day. What are some specific examples of this?
Theatre buildings have had to be really adaptable. Now, that might seem like a slightly odd thing to say, because at the end of the day, the word theatre describes both the activity that these buildings are primarily intended to house, performance, and the building itself. But really, post-war theatres are never just theatres, particularly the new purpose-built post-war theatres. They are places that people would come to, perhaps to socialise, to have a cup of coffee, perhaps to have some lunch. And so they're perhaps serving different constituencies during the day and then into the evening. More recently, theatres have had to be adaptable as well. The post-war theatres were designed and conceived for a very particular mode of subsidised operation. And as subsidies have been reduced since the 1980s, theatres have had to operate in different ways to increase their level of commercial income, to find new ways of making money. And in recent years, we've seen some quite interesting ways in which theatres have really been conceived in quite different, quite interesting ways. Buildings like Story House in Chester, for example, I think one of the really the most successful examples of recent years. Story House is the major theatre in Chester. It's housed within a former Odeon cinema building of the 1930s. But that building has also been converted to include Chester's Central Library. There's a very busy and popular bar and restaurant, and there's a cinema. And the building is open all day. And I think one of the great successes about Story House is that it is somewhere that you can just drop into. It is a public space within the city. You can go in, perhaps browse through a book, buy a cup of coffee if you want to, check your email. There's all sorts of things going on there. And it really is very much a civic kind of architecture, a public kind of architecture that is open to everyone. And so in that respect, I think we see some of the kind of egalitarian vision, the drive to open these buildings to the public and to see them as real public buildings, as civic spaces, surviving really well in the 21st century.
I feel like there's a lot of lessons from Alistair's conversation there in terms of how state-led policy interacts with the arts, and particularly in this time after the pandemic where the cultural sector has suffered enormously because of like the end of live theatre and gigs and all of this kind of stuff. There's clearly a lot to learn from the way that the state in the 20th century used its power to bring about spaces for cultural production and for social cultural interaction.
Absolutely. And I think what Alistair does as well is sort of show how we can look at buildings to tell stories about sort of political history or the history of arts policy and things that that buildings hold those stories within them, and they're kind of sources for understanding that as much as, you know, written sources or other kinds of things are as well.
Brill. Well, that's the end of today's episode. I hope you all enjoyed it. We've got a couple more coming down the pipeline in this series, so make sure you subscribe for access to them. If you enjoy the show, please give us a review on your podcast app, because it will help other people to find us. Lastly, if you're interested in any of the stuff we've been talking about over the course of these podcasts, there's no better thing to do than become a member of the SAHGB, which you can do through the link in the show notes.
This podcast has been produced by the Society of Architectural Historians of Great Britain, SAHGB. Established in 1956, we're the leading subject association for architectural history in the United Kingdom. Our educational mission is to promote architectural history inclusively to diverse audiences. Our mantra is all places, all periods, all welcome. We promote knowledge through learning, education, and research. We disseminate that knowledge through programming, content, and publications, and we advocate for the discipline and our members. To find out more about our work and to support our educational mission, please visit our website, sahgb.org.uk, or follow us at the SAHGB on Twitter or on Facebook. We are open to all. This podcast series has been created by Jessica Kelly, Matthew Lloyd Roberts, and Neil Sashore. The series is produced by Frontier. To find out more about them, visit frontierpodcasts.com.